be waiting for the slide to come up that announces the title of this message. It's called "And They All Lived Happily Ever After: Some Musings on Mark." I want to start the message by thanking the members of the Thursday night Bible discussion group that's for many months has been musing our way through Mark. Many of the thoughts that people have shared in that discussion group have been reflected in what I'm going to say, and so I thank everyone for their Zoom contributions to my thinking about Mark. The book of Mark is actually a surprising book. It tells the story of Jesus on earth, but there's one part of the story it doesn't tell, and it's interesting what Mark leaves out. So today we're going to look at this surprising book of Mark and see if there's anything about what is in it and also about what is not in it that may help us as followers of Jesus today. Okay then, what's missing in Mark? What's missing is the ending, the end of the story of Jesus on earth. We expect to hear about the resurrected Jesus and about how he interacted with his disciples and other people after he rose from the dead. The other books in the Bible that tell the story of Jesus, the other Gospels, they include that. But Mark doesn't. He does all the lead up to it. He records that Jesus dies on the cross, and he records how the women go to the tomb ready to prepare Jesus' body for burial. They find the tomb empty. They see a young man who tells them that Jesus is risen and they should tell the disciples about it. And then comes the final two verses in Mark. This is how the book ends. Trembling and bewildered, the women went out and fled from the tomb. They said nothing to anyone because they were afraid. And that's it. Boom. The end. What a weird and flat note to end the story on. Mark just lets the story fizzle out. Nobody does anything, and the story ends. It's very unsatisfactory. It is certainly not and they all lived happily ever after ending. I like books and movies and plays that have a happy ending. Sad endings upset me, and I tend to avoid them. But and ambivalent endings that are not clear, they drive me crazy. I like a story that ends, and I like it to end happily. But that's certainly not what I get when I read the story of Mark. And that's exactly what other people thought when the people who were writing the copies of Mark's book to distribute to other people in the early church. They actually borrowed parts of other Gospels and popped them into the end of Mark's account to round it out a bit more. So some Bibles will include those endings as in it, but they will usually make it really clear that that is not how Mark originally wrote this book. I approach the Bible on the basis that everything is in there for a reason, and things that are not in there are probably for a reason too. So it's worth thinking about why Mark does not end this book on a happily ever after note. Mark is a book that might speak to you if you're finding life a little bleak. For people who feel there's nothing much to look forward to, or feel that ahead of them there's possibly going to be more pain and suffering than joy and happiness. And that's a surprising number of us. Surprising because we often put our happy and our brave faces on when we are mixing with others. We don't want to be the person that gives off a negative vibe, and so we smile and others smile back at us. And it's only with our close friends or when we share regularly in a group that we can talk about the heaviest burdens that we are facing. I know, and you probably do know too, that within our church right now, there are people we know who are dealing with serious physical illnesses, but also mental illnesses, serious job problems, serious relationship problems, serious legal problems. And if we're not experiencing them ourselves, we often know others who are, and it's in our family, in our friends, and it can be really, really difficult to deal with. These are the sorts of problems that wake us up in a sweat at 4 a.m. in the morning, or we find ourselves our heart racing about or our stomachs churning about when we are alone with ourselves and our thoughts for a quiet moment. Things that make us wish that we had more faith and more trust so we didn't feel so anxious. And that's not factoring in things like the uncertainty of COVID, when you know so many of us are actually cut off from family and friends, and we know that if they need us, we cannot get to them. Or if we need them, they can't get to us. People living overseas or across borders. And COVID apart, even the experience of where we are right now as a church can make people feel anxious. Where we farewelled Peter, our minister, you know, last week. We won't get the new Peter until January. We are very much in a time between an end and a beginning. And that uncertainty or lack of clarity can make us feel anxious. So this book of Mark has something to say to people who are going through hard times. But Mark isn't just a gospel for people who are currently doing it tough. I've always remembered something that a friend of mine said to me when I was a teenager. I was about 16, and this friend of mine was a year or two older than me. I can't remember the context of his comments. It was probably in response to me gabbing on about something I was looking forward to or enjoying in my life. He didn't make his comments to me vindictively or sarcastically, but with a quiet intensity that I still remember really clearly, even almost 50 years later. This is what he said to me. "Louise, you do know it won't always be fun times. The time will come when things won't be so good for you." It later emerged that my friend was starting to experience the first torments of a serious mental health issue that meant his life completely unraveled from what he and his friends and his family had expected. My life has never unraveled like his, but his comments stay with me because he is right. Every person, including me, will experience bleak and dark periods in their lives. Times when we think life has lost its purpose or meaning, or when we don't know what to do next, or if we're caught in a fog of pain, physical or emotional pain, or fear we've reached the end of the story and things are just fizzling out. No happy endings. A bit like Mark's gospel. But I know some of you will be thinking, but things didn't fizzle out. There was a happy ending for the women and for the disciples' followers. But what happy ending are you thinking of? Jesus turning up again after he was resurrected to spend some quality time with his disciples? Yep, that would have been a high point. Or after Jesus had left earth, but 50 days after his resurrection, there was Pentecost, that time where the disciples and the followers of Jesus had an amazing experience of the sense of God's closeness and power. That would have been a super high point. But almost immediately, those new Christians are targets. Suddenly, they're outside of the protection of Jewish and Roman law, and the followers of Jesus are hunted down, imprisoned, and sometimes killed. Imagine us meeting as a church, but listening is a forced entry by people who want to and are able to kill us for being followers of Jesus. Just imagine it, never feeling safe, always looking around to see where you might go to hide if you needed to, worrying about what you might be dragging and exposing your children or your parents or your friends to, grieving for people who've been taken, wondering and worrying if you're going to have the strength to stand up for Jesus if you're taken. Living like that wouldn't have felt like a completely happy ending. So this end of Mark captures something true about Christian life and life in general. At times it will be hard going. We will have times of feeling bewildered or terrified or not sure if there are happier days ahead. But Mark isn't written just to tell us something that we probably already know, that life is full of ups and downs, that the story isn't finished and won't be until we're completely united with God. Christians know in their heads that asking why me when difficulties strike is a complete waste of time. We all know in our heads that to get to that great cosmic celebration that is heaven, we will need to go through pain and suffering, and we will certainly need to die, because it is only beyond death that complete happiness lies. So what does Mark communicate that helps us in our hearts when we find ourselves struggling through life? Before I look at a few key points of Mark, I want to make a more general point about approaching the Bible for guidance. One of the things that has helped me get much more excited about reading the Bible in recent years is that I finally grasped the reality that the Bible is one complete whole, that unified reality. It's not just a series of books and letters that have been placed between the covers of one book, but it is telling a complete story. Sure, there are lots of shorter stories within it and smaller stories, but these always fit into a larger narrative. The Bible is full of patterns and repeating motifs, beautifully woven together to provide a consistent and endlessly varying way of communicating the plan of God to unite the whole world through Jesus. And that's one of the reasons that we watched that video earlier that gives us an overview of the whole Bible. We can sometimes get quite the wrong idea by pulling out a piece of the Bible and looking at it closely, but not putting it where it belongs in the Bible and looking at the big picture that surrounds it, so that we take the step back to see it in its larger context. So of course, the end of Mark is designed to be read with a clear knowledge of what lies ahead. It's part of that much bigger picture that includes the resurrection and the power of Pentecost and the amazing story of the early church. And Mark is also designed to be read with a clear knowledge of what has come before, so that people who have been God followers before Jesus was on earth, their story we know. We know people like Job, who was just battered by life but was able to hold on to faith. We're able to hear stories of people who were in impossible situations but somehow came through, people like David and Daniel and Rahab and Ruth. And those stories repeat one of the themes that's embedded right through the Bible, that we should approach hardship with hope and perseverance, secure in the knowledge that we are loved by God and can trust that love to somehow get it through. And doesn't it sound so easy when I say it like that? It's like, just have faith. But there's a truly daunting section in the 11th chapter of Mark. Oh, that's right. Jesus says, have faith in God. I tell you the truth. If anyone says to this mountain, go throw yourself in the sea, and does not doubt in his heart, but believes that what he says will happen, it will be done for him. Therefore, I tell you that whatever you ask for in prayer, believe you have received it, and it will be yours. But if you think that means that Christians who are suffering just lack faith, then you need to put that particular verse or verses back where they belong in Mark 11, because you need to read all that chapter to realise that the mountain that is being referred to is the temple, getting rid of the old way of religion. And you should also look at what else Jesus says about faith in times of difficulty. Just a few pages earlier in the book, Mark tells a story of a man who must have felt there would be no happily ever after moment for him. For years, he's been living a nightmare. He has a son who has what we describe today probably as having symptoms of uncontrolled epilepsy. Can you imagine the vigilance required by this child's family, never knowing when his body will react and hurl itself into danger? This child has been burnt by fire, has almost drowned, and there is no end to the suffering in sight. And when this child's father asked Jesus if he can do anything for his son, Jesus says, everything is possible for him who believes. And we think, uh-oh, there's that demand to have a big faith. But listen to what the man says. I do believe. Help me to overcome my unbelief. And did Jesus say, no, no unbelief allowed here. It's got to be 100% faith or nothing. No, Jesus said nothing. He just healed the boy. And readers of Mark from its beginning won't be surprised, because right at the start of Mark, Jesus tells us that something very, very tiny has the potential to grow and become much more over time. The tiny mustard seed is valued in and of itself because of its potential. That is the way that the kingdom of God operates. Your faith, my faith, are treasured by God. It's treasured. No matter how tiny and fragile, just being brave enough to ask God for help, to be prepared to accept that there is the possibility of change and growth, that is treasured by God. It's enough that mixed in with all the trembling and the bewilderment is a strand of faith, a willingness to believe that God knows what you're going through and will give you strength to grow and flourish, whatever your circumstances. And above all, your willingness to acknowledge that you are not in charge of your life, but that God is, and you're prepared to accept that. Because it is not our faith that determines the outcomes of our prayers. It is always God's will that determines that. If God's will and ours don't line up, then we won't experience what we pray for. Faith is trusting that God's will is to know what is the best possible outcome for you. And faith is accepting that God does know what you really want right now, but that it is possible that it is not best for you to have it right now. And to give us a bit of an insight into how this process of lining up God's will and our will goes, Mark recounts two encounters that Jesus has. Both these stories have got a bit to say about wanting happily ever after endings. The first story, it's a cracker. It's all about the disciples being really bad at being followers of Jesus. Actually, Mark's gospel is full of stories about the disciples that get it wrong. He shows the disciples in a really bad light. They completely miss the point of the stories that Jesus tells. They try to big note themselves. They actually block children from coming to Jesus. They fight amongst themselves. They get really mad at Jesus at one point because he's not taking care of them in a storm. And in another story, they see Jesus turn two loaves and five fish into an all-you-can-eat picnic for over 5,000 people. But they panic a few chapters later on when they have to feed a smaller crowd and they still have Jesus with them, and this time they have seven loaves as well as some fish. But the story that we're going to look at in the ninth chapter of Mark really shows two of the disciples plummeting really low depths. It's about James and John, who actually don't really want to be Jesus' followers at all. They're setting their targets higher. They more want to be side by side with Jesus, wielding a bit of executive power and sharing his limelight. And if prayer is defined as going to Jesus with our heartfelt requests, James and John did some praying. And they certainly had faith. At this point of the story, they were very confident that Jesus was going to overcome all the earthly opposition to his ministry and bring in a triumphant and glorious conclusion. So what was James and John's prayer? They started by saying to Jesus, "Teacher," they said, "we want you to do whatever you ask us, whatever we ask, whatever we ask." Now, that's boldness in prayer, isn't it? But not very much humility, maybe a little touch of arrogance. But Jesus graciously requires, "What do you want me to do for you?" And they replied, "Let one of us sit at your left side, one of us sit on your right side in your glory." Interestingly, Jesus doesn't respond to that by saying, "How dare you ask that," or "That's not God's will," or even "Don't be ridiculous." If you read the rest of the story, you'll see that Jesus responds to James and John by explaining the implications of what it actually means to be a co-heir with Jesus, sharing in his glory, sitting on either side of him. Jesus explains that the way to share in his glory also involves sharing in his suffering. And the way to greatness is not looking great and looking powerful or exercising worldly power, but serving, being a servant to others. Jesus says it to James and John at one point, you don't know what you're asking for. And because we do know the end of the story, we know that James and John do end up sharing in the suffering and pain. James is imprisoned and executed by King Herod, the puppet king, only about 10 or so years after he has this conversation with Jesus. John lives much longer, but he spends his final days on an island, exiled, cut off from the Christian community. But when he was there, he saw the glory of God. We know that he did because he wrote a book about it. It's called Revelation. It's the last book in the Bible. This time, though, the focus of his vision is not fixated on his place in it and the way that glory spills over onto him. It is all about the power of God and the purpose of the final days coming through some end and terrible times to a new heaven, a new earth, where God is the sole focus of worship. And so we have this story of two of Jesus' close followers approaching Jesus in great faith with a prayer request that is eventually answered, but in a very different way to which they expected. And straight after this story of the disciples' prayer requests, in exactly the same chapter of Mark, immediately following, there is another story about exercising faith by putting a heartfelt request to Jesus. But this time, the lead-in is very different. Remember John and James' bossy lead-in to their request to Jesus, you know, we want you to do whatever we ask you. Well, this time the story starts with a plea, not a command. Jesus is walking with a large crowd following him, and a man starts yelling out, Jesus, son of David, have mercy on me. It's Bartimaeus, and he is blind. The story goes on. Many rebuked him and told him to be quiet, but he shouted all the more, son of David, have mercy on me. Jesus responds to his plea. Jesus stopped and said, call him. So they called the blind man, cheer up, on your feet, he's calling you. Throwing his cloak aside, he jumped to his feet and he came to Jesus. And listen to what Jesus said. He says exactly what he said to James and John, exactly the same words. What do you want me to do for you? Rabbi, he said, I want to see. Go, said Jesus. Your faith has healed you. Immediately, he received his sight and followed Jesus along the road. Jesus acknowledges his faith, Bartimaeus can see, and what does Bartimaeus immediately do? Join the crowd following Jesus, not trying to get up on his left or his right side, but following him. A happily ever after story for Bartimaeus? You might think so, but maybe not, because where is Jesus leading this crowd? Jesus is on his way to Jerusalem, straight to Jerusalem, where all of Jesus' enemies are based. In less than a week after Bartimaeus receives his sight, Mark tells us Jesus is dead. The crowd, including Bartimaeus, will have quietly melted away. Mark paints a picture of a deserted Christ, alone facing his torturers and executioners, with only a few of his followers, all women, on a hillside, watching his final hours. And even those who'd been brave enough to see Jesus die are left at the end of Mark, in those final two verses of Mark, terrified and bewildered, saying nothing to anyone because they're afraid. What to me is one of the most comforting things about Mark, with his bleak endings and his constant tales of the disciples that get everything wrong, and followers that don't stick up for Jesus and don't stay with him is that even though his followers might give up on Jesus, Jesus never gives up on them. The disciples get it wrong. They think they're all alone and uncared for. They complain about that. They mess up. They pray for things that, without realizing the implications, but Jesus never suspends them or sacks them. Even the one he knows is going to betray him, he does not push him away. Jesus is never the one who puts distance between himself and his followers. The Bible doesn't promise us happily ever after stories on earth. That is strictly the domain of heaven. Jesus promises his followers sustenance for our journey on earth, a welcome for our faith, even if it's as small as a mustard seed and coated with doubt, and our terror and our bewilderment at times when our life is going well, is going badly, don't repulse him. So if you're feeling bewildered, terrified, or less than full of faith, the book of Mark tells you that nothing you can do, nothing that you fear, will stop Jesus counting you as a disciple. You are one of his, and you will always be that. And clinging on to that and reaching out to others will be enough to get you through the hardest times. We're now going to hear our final song being sung. Jasmine's going to be singing Waymaker. It talks of God being light in the darkness. And one of the lines that it's got in it, it says that even if we don't feel it or see it, God is always at work. So may that thought sustain you in the coming week.